This is episode 2E of Free As in Freedom for Tuesday, July 17th, 2012. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free As in Freedom.
Now without buffer overruns.
Awesome.
Well, we don't know yet. I'm recording on a different partition.
I hope that works. I actually didn't hear the skip, but I didn't. This is me revealing that Bradley does. I think everybody who listens regularly knows that Bradley does most of the work in that's not done by Dan Lynch.
Well, you're just revealing that you've never actually listened to an episode of
Free As in Freedom. That's not true. I have. I have on multiple occasions, including one or two, I think, where I did the show notes.
Okay. And Free As in Freedom.
I'm Free As in Freedom.
Really?
Thought so.
Okay.
Definitely the Software Freedom Law Show.
Well, I did a
whole bunch of those.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I thought I did one or two for Free As in Freedom.
But do you want to bet on this?
No.
Darn. Okay.
Yeah.
I was just going to make some money from Karen, but she won't bet. So
I'm not the betting type.
I know. We've done this before. We've been in this place before.
We have.
This is the last FOSDEM show, FOSDEM 2012, the conference that ended in February. In July, we have the final installment. We missed Dave Neary's talk, as we've talked about, which we're sorry about. But this is the last, that was the only talk in the end that we had to miss, and we've got the whole
track. Is that true?
Track. I think that
right,
was correct.
There was our substitution talk, wasn't worth playing.
Yeah, no. That was just us. The people were going to hear us. They're going to hear us anyway.
That's true.
So they don't need to hear more us.
But wouldn't that be kind of meta?
No, because we've done our own talk recordings before. We did your talk at OzCon.
And we did actually play... Did we not play I think we did play a talk where the two of us gave a talk at a conference. I think that was maybe a talk about the GCC exception, runtime library exception.
No, we didn't record that one. That was a horrendous talk.
That wasn't a very
good
talk.
Don't even talk about that talk. That was the worst talk we ever gave.
We've done a few talks together.
The worst talk I ever gave. I think it was the worst talk you ever gave. And collectively is the worst talk we ever gave together.
That's true.
The only thing good about that talk was Bedell asked some useful questions and we... talked back and forth with Bedell, but that was the only thing good about
it. I don't think it was actually the worst talk I ever gave.
It was a really bad talk.
It wasn't that bad.
It was pretty bad.
It wasn't good.
It was pretty bad.
But it wasn't as bad as the one I gave on nonprofits, the first talk I gave.
Are you talking about the one at that thing?
I am.
Let's not go there. But early on,
I was giving bad talks. It was just excruciatingly boring. I may still be excruciatingly boring, but at least
I'm always excruciatingly boring. That's not the issue.
But the GCC talk we gave wasn't nearly as boring.
Right, but we did talk in detail on an old episode of the old show, I think, about the GCC exception. So
I
it sort of was
did.
Like that talk, but it was not the talk
because
the talk was bad. So this is a talk that is not bad. From Mike Linkspayer, who was the final speaker. He got the worst slot in some ways, the final slot of the day. Actually, maybe the first slot was the worst slot because people weren't there yet.
Yeah, it was packed, as I recall.
It was packed the whole day.
I was sitting on the steps in the aisle.
Yeah, and I was...
And there were plenty of people standing in the back, and it was standing room only.
Yeah, it was standing room only because I went to the back by the windows because it was too hot in that room by that time. So, because they turned the heat on. Because it was nice and cold, and I didn't have a coat. Remember this? I had no coat.
I do remember.
In Belgium. I didn't bring a coat. I'd never been to Europe in the winter before.
But it was also unseasonably cold. It was like a really... It was a cold snap.
It was particularly
bad. A lot of people
bad.
Died in that cold snap.
I did not die.
Yeah, and then I
had no coat, but I did not die.
I'm really glad.
Yeah.
And when I went to Mallorca afterwards, which was also unseasonably cold.
What's your orca?
Hey.
I don't know what that is, actually. I don't know
where
that is.
You don't know where Mallorca is?
I don't know where Mallorca is. Where is it?
It's near Ibiza. It's an island off of Spain.
Oh. Well, there's islands everywhere.
There's some interesting facts about Mallorca that probably our listeners don't care about.
I'm sure they don't.
Like, Chopin got very sick in Mallorca because he also had a cold winter in Mallorca.
Oh.
When he was there with Georges Sand. Bradley is giving me this look of, like, I won't even make eye contact with you because I'm so bored by what you say and it's so irrelevant to anything that I care about.
Well, we have to talk about this talk.
Okay. Well, I would say we don't have to talk about this talk until after mm-hmm. our listeners hear the talk. And I would say, for those of you who, for whom it's easy to do so, we do have slides, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I would listen to it with the slides, I think, especially for the second half of the talk.
And there's a number of points where Mike makes reference to things that are on the slides too. So you really probably want to have them. If you can't, then there's parts you may want to skip because he's making reference to text on the slides. So it might be a little confusing. But other than that, enjoy the talk.
I'm going to talk a fair bit about 4.0. I want to start by talking a little bit about public policy. These are my overall aims for the talk, basically to encourage people who are interested in philosophy, legal, and policy stuff to broaden your interest in activism in two dimensions. One is that domains other than software that use very similar tools or often actually use free software licenses anyway need your expertise, and it's in your interest to help there when you have time. The other is that we need more pro-freedom public policy. So I want to start on the public policy part. And although the last panel is a little bit of a counterexample, most of the policy discussed in this room has been basically about how do you run a free software project? How does a free software project relate to a corporation? Questions like that. And that's really, really important policy. But I think if free software is important, as most of us who came to this conference probably think it is, we also need to think a lot more about public policy. Kind of starting from the bottom, Creative Commons and people in the open content, open access, open education sort of field have had a number of small successes in recent years getting funders and governments to mandate, usually using a CC license when for educational materials, for example. And I know that there's been a fair amount of activism, especially from the FSFE in the software world. I'm not very familiar with it, and I think, and I'm probably one of the few people who probably would be familiar with sort of the public policy activism in both domains. I think that probably indicates a potential problem that either there's not enough, well, I think there's not enough public policy activism on the Creative Commons sort of side of things, but I suspect there's also not nearly enough in the free software world, and maybe some of that could be solved by us working together more. I mean, one anecdote: there was a talking to a major funder of open educational materials, and at some point, free software and free formats came up, and they said basically that years ago they decided that teachers, you know, even if they're creating free educational materials, they're going to use Microsoft Word, and it's just pointless to even engage in that conversation. And that may be practical for them, you know, on a day-to-day basis, but it's also kind of sad that free software has not made its case well enough that somebody who is really passionate about open education, you know, doesn't see the necessity of promoting free software in educational context as well as free content. I also want to point out that this isn't what I think of as public policy is really about promoting promoting social good or social welfare. And so if we get really good at promoting free software and free culture as public policy, that scales up to governments and international organizations, but also down to business corporate responsibility sort of policies and also individuals seeing it as their social responsibility to use free software, not because it gives them freedom, but because by not using free software, they're promoting non-freedom for society. I think freedom as a social responsibility is very different from the kind of freedom as a feature that essentially open source represents, and the freedom to control your own computing that free software usually represents. So I would continue on the public policy vein. If free software, I don't know why it's saying mirror screens. If free software is really important, really socially important, then I think that voluntary public licenses, including strong copyleft ones, are inadequate for the task. They're extremely important. Don't get me wrong. I've been working in an organization developing voluntary public licenses for 8 years. So I think they're important. But let me show you a web page. Wrong one. So we have this web page, I think in the last 18 months, published by the Free Software Foundation, talking about the advantages of free software, basically saying, why ask about the advantages of free software? Proprietary software is the equivalent of handcuffs, and you know, if you're wearing handcuffs, you basically can't do anything. I think that only works if, for whatever reason, you have a personality that intuitively gets that software freedom is important. Just stating it is not very convincing to most of the population. Most of the population uses proprietary software, and they don't feel the handcuffs. They don't feel like they can't carry a backpack because they're, or whatever the computing equivalent of that is. So I think that we need to dramatically expand the ethical and other kind of social good arguments that we're making. I actually think this is the most important policy challenge for free software and also for free content. It's not how do we make our projects a little bit more efficient and not get exploited by corporations and those sorts of things. It's convincing the broad population, but also opinion leaders, for lack of a better term, that software freedom really matters, is really crucial to the future of society. And I think that if free software ethics is really important, then, for example, moral philosophers need to be thinking about it, and not just in terms of freedom, which is important ethically, but also you have equality for something that's often seen as a dual of freedom. And free software has a great equality story, but it's rarely made. I think it's really crucial that it be made. Economists and other social scientists need to really care about this. There's somebody made the point about things being cyclical. Oh, it was Allison Randall making a point about history repeating. You can also see that with broader debates about intellectual freedom and the knowledge commons. I think in the mid to late 1800s, there was a lot of debate about patents, and in fact, either the Netherlands or Switzerland actually abolished patents briefly. And economists were actually extremely involved in that debate and importance in it. But essentially, freedom lost that debate, and industry that just wanted another method to extract rents won it. And economists especially, but social scientists generally, kind of forgot about patents and copyright and other things, you know, after that. And I think to the great detriment of freedom throughout the 20th throughout the 20th century. And of course, human rights activists, et cetera, should care. And there are, of course, people making these points. I highly recommend Karen's talk from LCA as well as Jake Applebaum's. But then one final point on the public policy side. I was happy to see, I can't remember his name, but somebody was making the point about political activism and free software in the morning, and gave as a positive example activism against SOPA and PIPA. I think it's fantastic that the technology industry, and in particular free software and free culture activists, really have been great in fighting ACTA and SOPA. However, I'm really disappointed that free software and free culture activism aren't seen as part of the opposition. Basically, if more of the world was using free software and much of the culture we were participating in was free, there wouldn't be a constituency for things that would break the internet. So I'd like to see the freedom activists, at least the Vanguard's mission, to be to change from participating in reactionary activism, which is certainly necessary, but at the very least make proactive activism that is pro free software part of the conversation. Just one more point that I really want to make. Free software, of course, requires access to source so that you can learn from it, so that you can modify it, so that you can share it. That actually points to another big way to expand the way we think about policy, and that is it's not just a matter of software being released under a free license. It's also does the public actually have access to source? And this can be a consumer safety sort of question. And we should be able to get people who are, if we can't get people who are interested in things like consumer safety to be free software advocates, then we're either just wrong and free software isn't that important, or we're making bad arguments. Okay, so this is kind of a joke that was on Identica, where Evan Perdomo was saying that someday knowing the ins and outs of copyright will be like knowing obscure rules from a past totalitarian age. Ironically, the remainder of this talk is 100% about that. And how much time do I have left?
You have 15 minutes.
Great. Because I think, of course, that public licenses are really important for free software and for free culture. The next couple of slides are the second part about making a case that people interested in FLOSS, legal, and policy should expand your interest a little bit. So I want to, there are a bunch of different domains, software being one, that people have created licenses, created public, mainly copyright licenses tailored to. And of course, software led the way. There's also content, if you can accept that word, that Creative Commons is normally applied to. You've got hardware, databases, fonts, public sector information, software documentation, such as the FDL is a license created specifically for software documentation, standards documentation. And I say that we mostly avoided domain-specific licenses for educational material, scientific communications, music, and wikis, although you can kind of make the case that we haven't truly avoided them, but I don't have time to make the case. So some of the many, then these are just examples to provide evidence that we actually do have domain-specific licenses for all of those domains. An interesting thing, though, is that in all of those domains, in addition to software and content, free software licenses or Creative Commons licenses have been used in those domains. So what do those sort of overlap between applications of free software and free cultural licenses and these domain-specific mechanisms? What does that actually mean? Well, it could mean that a kind of license proliferation, especially to accommodate the specifics of different domains, is underrated as a problem, because it's a good thing that people are innovating and making these, you know, licenses that are really tailored to the need of font designers, for example. Could mean that it's overrated. I mean, it could mean that it is, overrated as a problem. It could be that license proliferation is actually underrated as a problem, and that it's really kind of a small tragedy that people are creating licenses tailored to these different domains, because they often don't know how to do it well, and in the long term, incompatibility is going to be a big problem, and they, you know, really should be using the GPL for everything, maybe. If you want to boil it down to a really simple yes or no, there's a question about what do we win via the features of new licenses versus what are the costs of further silos? Whatever the answer to that is, I think that FLOSS legal and policy experts can benefit the world by sharing your expertise, because free software is generally a number of years ahead and has much bigger pool of expertise than people developing specific licenses for other domains, including content. Another kind of subsidiary question from that is that CC has always strongly disrecommended using CC licenses, any of the CC licenses, except for more recently a public domain dedication we have, for software, because we realized that would kind of, if we didn't, it would just pollute the free software pool. You'd have a bunch of people using incompatible and even non-free licenses. So I think that's been a very good thing that CC has done. But given that free software licenses are used across a bunch of these different domains, are there sort of domains that free software should either explicitly disclaim and say, don't use a free software license for this, or should free software embrace some of these domains? And why does CC exist as it is, I think, is sort of a question that comes naturally from this kind of thinking. And I think it's in part because free software was not paying. Free software, I mean, there's no entity that is free software, but in general, free software people in the late 90s, when people were inventing, people saw the success of free software, like, gee, maybe we could do this with books or music or whatever. Free software people weren't paying super close attention to that. And I don't know if, and so that allowed people to kind of make up a bunch of bogus licenses in the late 90s and early 2000s, and then for Creative Commons, which had some notoriety and some money, etc., to essentially drop a neutron bomb on the nascent field of open content licenses and become the only the by far the most relevant entity. And I think that because we now know that sort of thing happens, I think we should be thinking proactively when people are discussing new licenses for open hardware or whatever. The free software community needs to be paying attention and guiding the discussion. Okay, so Creative Commons 4.0 licenses is what I'm going to talk about the rest of the time. Some of the issues that are being considered that might be of interest to you. And I'll just say again, I think some of these issues should be of interest to you because you're probably going to encounter Creative Commons 4.0 licenses eventually in your career as a free software advocate or developer or whatever, because they're going to be very widely adopted. And as you saw several slides ago, there are a bunch of domains where, you know, both free software licenses and Creative Commons licenses have been used. So first I want to go over some of the goals of the process we have. The first being internationalization. Historically, Creative Commons has done something that hasn't been done for free software licenses, although the UPL is sort of an exception. And that is, we say we port Creative Commons licenses to different jurisdictions, which is sort of odd because all of the licenses are intended to work globally. In any case, in the version 3.0, we removed most of the U.S. specific language, or language that was drawn from U.S. law and convention. And we need to complete that process in 4.0. And I personally would like to have a license that was seen as internationally, or as international enough that we wouldn't have to do porting anymore. We never had to do porting, but politically, there are many reasons why if we don't do a great job, we'd have to continue porting. GPLv3 did a lot of work on internationalization. I've heard people mention in passing that there are lessons to be learned from that, things that maybe could have been done even better than were done. Or so I'd really like to hear about from the free software, in particular GPLv3 experience, what CC should be taking into account in terms of internationalization. Interoperability, I'll talk more about that. Okay. I'll talk more about stuff on this slide, the next slide. So there's a big tension with license versioning, like CC 4.0, and that is, do you try to be visionary or have continuity? Do I have 5 minutes? Okay. Or rather, for each decision, whether you try to make visionary changes or continuity, what's really best for developing the commons, I think is the right question. Moral rights, this is what we have in the license now. It's long and hard to understand and needs clarification, but I'm not going to say anything more about it. I'm not going to say anything about sui generis database rights. That is, this is another Identica conversation. It's something that you shouldn't want to know about. Basically, it's a new restriction automatic that's kind of like copyright on database compilations. The problem is that Creative Commons licenses don't currently give permission to users if they would be impacted by these rights, and so we need to get that right in version 4.0. And there's sort of a peevish joke in the last bullet, but I won't read it. M stands for emulated human, but I think the problem with sui generis restrictions, though, is kind of interesting in that if innovation policy, whatever, intellectual protectionism, whatever you want to call it, continues to go in a bad direction over the next years, people are probably going to make up other new rights. And one of the issues with CC 4.0, I think, and that also free software people I'd be thinking about is how do we make our mechanisms robust to this kind of negative change. So there's also discussion about what to do with our non-free licenses. And it's not very interesting for this venue. So I'm going to skip over that. So copyleft scope, so we have a copyleft license called Attribution Share Alike. We might want to make it stickier, make it a stronger copyleft. In that sense, there are a lot of interesting issues that I don't have time to go to there. Okay, so DRM is an issue that you'll all be interested in. Currently, CC licenses prohibit it with this language. And a number of people from free software communities, primarily Debian, have actually not liked this prohibition because it's a restriction on what you can do with content. You can't distribute with DRM, even though we all hate DRM. So there are a few interesting options. The parallel distribution has been considered in the past. We might consider it again. I like the idea of permitting circumvention. So I just want to talk about one other thing I've done. So interoperability or compatibility, really, with other licenses, there's alignment. So making sure that the conditions in CC licenses match up well with other licenses. It gets interesting when you want to have compatibility with other copyleft licenses. One sort of more in CC's domain that could be interesting would be the free art license, the free documentation license, and open database license. I think the most interesting thing with those is probably governance, in that if we were bilateral compatible with any of those, that brings up interesting issues around future versions, and because it's essentially you're binding. If everybody has future versions clauses, then users are sort of trusting in the stewardship of all of those organizations. And that's probably part of the reason, as far as I know, there's no bilateral compatibility among copyleft licenses and software. GPL is interesting just in part because it might be healthy for the non-software freedom to develop more of a source culture, and that implies that maybe a source requiring copyleft license could be useful some of the time. It doesn't make any sense to invent yet another one, and so some limited form of GPL compatibility one way could be interesting. Then there's readability to be considered, and this is sort of a joke. We're at the end. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
So Karen, we want to discuss a little bit about what Mike said in his talk.
But what was the license of the talk?
So the license of the entire episode is going to be our usual license. But actually, Mike was kind enough to record a message for us. He's got a special message for you, our listeners.
And I'm excited because I think I heard this a while ago, but I
no, didn't. You never heard it actually.
Oh, I never heard it. We talked about what it was, but I'm excited to hear it.
Yeah, so we have a special message from Mike Linksfair to our listeners about the license of his talk.
Here it is.
Words and slides associated with this presentation are released under the CC0 public domain dedication. Additionally, I grant you royalty-free patent license for any patents I control or will control that you would infringe by using these works under CC0. And finally, should you need CC0's fallback license, I grant you the additional permission to sublicense these works. I wouldn't mention these additional permissions if this were not an advanced forum, meaning some of you may have read CC0 and might get such inside quasi-jokes about CC0.
So as Mike said, he actually put his talk under CC0.
I think we don't need a funny thing for this episode because that's the funny thing. It's in the funny thing is in our episode because Mike provided the funny thing.
That could be true. I guess we could have put it at the end for that. But I wanted to discuss it briefly because the make sure folks understood the inside joke with regard to the fact that there's this issue.
Well, if
with
they
the
follow you or Fontana on Identica, they already know.
That's true, but a lot of people probably don't. I'm sure many of our listeners don't even know. Well, they know what Identica is, but they don't read it, I'm sure. But,
yeah, maybe. But Mike also referred to other Identica.
In his talk, it's
his
true.
Talk.
So I mean, I think he's right, actually, when he said about that there's these arcane rules of copyright and this joke that Evan made about the in the future people will know these from some totalitarian regime. The other thing I liked that he did bring in the early part of his talk, he actually addressed a question that bothers me, which he talked in more detail about why we need to reach regular people, because I don't actually believe we need to reach regular people. And he had some sort of new reasons.
And I really believe that we need to.
I know you do.
So I was so excited that he was talking about that and that he devoted a significant chunk of his talk to that. Plus, he mentioned my talk.
Yeah, well, he did in that context as a opportunity or a way to reach regular people about this issue. But one thing he said about this issue of equality was important, and I think that actually kind of relates to my complaints about not reaching normal people, as it were, because it is an equality issue of people having equal access to their own software, even if they're not programmers, and that's an issue.
I thought it was so interesting for him to refer to it as a great equality story, because I don't think we've really talked about it in terms of a great equality story.
No.
And I think he's right to kind of point that out and sort of, you know, as a real failure of advocacy, generally. I think we can do a lot better. And I've been sort of scratching my head about what the best ways are to reach ordinary people. I mean, one of the reasons why I'm at GNOME is because I think that it's so important to reach ordinary people, and having software that anybody can use is one of the fundamental components of that. And, you know, if I can't explain to people why that's important, then, you know, what am I doing? So I actually think that he's really right. And I'm wondering if maybe we just need, we need to collectively write that a great equality story and then tell it.
Perhaps. Also, his point about that there aren't people who are philosophers, and he talks about the patents and economists looking at the patent system and debating the patent system when it was becoming what it is today in the 1800s, and that there isn't really that happening. That there's most of the people who would be analysts of free software are mostly opportunists, and that really troubles me. That they're mostly folks who are trying. The people that are given that credit are people like Matt Assay and these people who are really just opportunists trying to find a way to make money with it and that sort of thing, rather than people who are saying, what is the right public policy with regard to software?
Well, this is one of those tricky reasons why we have difficulty explaining why free software is a bona fide charitable purpose in a lot of circumstances. It's because, or we get into murky waters a lot because I think that because there's a real business interest in it as well, it's confusing to people where the ethical arguments are and how those policy arguments differ from a business opportunity. So I think you're right, but I think that actually it's on us to do a better job.
Well, maybe, but I think it is a problem. Certainly, we could always do a better job. Anybody doing any job could be doing a better job. But there's no meeting this issue halfway because people do not treat technology as a political issue. The way, for example, and actually it's not true in Europe because it's a settled debate, but in a place like the United States where we're debating healthcare, and healthcare is a debate and it's a public policy debate that we actually have, and there's plenty of financial interest, and there's plenty of companies that make money from healthcare and are manipulating the healthcare system for money, just like proprietary software companies. But we've decided in the United States as a culture to at least have a public debate, which is kind of funny because you think about how advanced Europe and Canada are with such better healthcare systems, and we're still debating. But at least it's a political issue. Technology is not even a political issue in the United States.
We haven't explained it to people. We haven't explained to people why they should care. and why it is a political issue.
No, I'm just talking about free software. It's all technology. Nobody cares. Nobody thinks that technology is a political issue.
I think that people do think of some aspects of technology as a political issue. But I think that in general, they don't think of they definitely don't think of software as a political issue. And getting them to see software as a potentially political issue is such an important thing, and it's something that we're not addressing. And Mike says that we should have, consumer safety experts involved, and I think that's right. But I think that also sort of veers us a little bit off course from this basic argument of, why is there an ethical component to free software, and why does it matter? And as I was listening to his talk, I was thinking that actually my medical devices advocacy only really goes a very small part of the way, because it's advocating generally more for software transparency. I don't really tend to get into the equality issues at all. And I think we need to. And I say we as nonprofit advocates and, advocates for software freedom. But I also mean sort of we, the membership of the FSF, you're on the board of the FSF. I think that's something that that I would love to see more of from the FSF, because they're really well positioned to do that. And I think that maybe if we, I don't know, I'm thinking out loud here.
I think if we could get
nonprofits generally in our space to band together in this way, it would be very helpful.
I mean, I actually know the FSF wants to do that. So there's two parts of what Mike said. One is the reaching normal people, as it were, and who, like he said, don't see themselves as handcuffed when they use proprietary software. So that issue, I think FSF does want to learn from and get better at. I readily admit this as a board member, it's not an organization that has a lot of people in it that aren't technologists, and it's difficult for folks who aren't from our community from our community to understand. And there's been efforts in the FSF to try and bridge that gap, and it's a very difficult thing to bridge. On the other part of the issue, which is the public policy, the way most public policy is influenced and done in the United States is through lobbyists. And obviously 501c3s can't lobby, so it's not the FSF's place. I actually think we need free software lobbyists.
I agree with you that we need free software lobbyists, and that it's not the Free Software Foundation's or any other C3's place to do that. But I don't think actually making good policy arguments, drawing those lines between, telling the equality story of free software and of talking about it as an ethical issue. I think that's something that just sort of telling the story is something that is perfectly appropriate for these charities to be doing.
True.
And we're not doing it.
Well, I think, and nobody wants to hear the story. I mean, that's the problem.
Nobody wants to hear the story because we're not telling it in a compelling way. Maybe we need
But it's not actually, the thing is, it's not a compelling story for most people. And this is where I sort of become completely in disagreement with everybody, because I actually don't think that the free software argument by itself, I think the way you've coupled it with the issue of healthcare and the issue of safety for yourself and for those who have devices in their body, that's a coupling that works and can convince people. But the straight free software issue of you can hire anybody you want to fix your bugs and you have a right to fix your bugs yourself and all those sorts of things, those benefits are just not benefits that people see outright. They get ancillary benefits from other people taking advantage of those things.
Maybe we need to do like an It's a Wonderful Life version of what would the world be like without free software? What would we be missing because of the freedoms that we get from software? From software freedom.
And we have to make it up. It'll be fiction.
Well, but we can use facts to point to the actual innovations and developments that we have from free software.
But then we're back to people love Apple, right? People love a totalitarian state. I mean, that's the issue. People want to be in a totalitarian state. I mean, that's my sad view of humanity. I think that most people are happy to be under a dictator who doesn't treat them too badly.
I think people just don't understand because they haven't had the issues spelled out for them in the right way. I think people do understand that Apple makes a lot of bad choices in terms of, ethical decisions. And people have said, I hear people sort of referring to their iPhones as with a little bit of guilt. I know this isn't so great, but
Well, the guilt is probably because they spent way too much money on a telephone, but...
Oh, I don't think that's where the guilt is.
I mean, this is such a hard... Actually, a very amusing story related to spending too much money on technology. So I had a very enjoyable conversation with one of Conservancy's directors, Mark Galassi, who was, he was sort of asking about, like, well, where is the tablet market and what... And it, can you actually have software freedom on it? And he told him the usual answer, which is very complicated. And some Android devices you can build your own. There's not many tablets that you can actually build your own. A lot of them have proprietary drivers and so forth. And so he called me today at the day of recording and said he asked me another question. He said, oh, I wanted to tell you the end of the tablet story. He said, I took the $300 that I was going to spend on a tablet and decided that the software freedom issues are just so bad, and I bought a better bicycle. And he says, my plan is I'll just bike faster to a real computer and then use that when I need mobile computing.
That's great.
But I mean, that's a guy who's been deeply involved in software freedom issues for many years, saying... because he's a scientist, and therefore he doesn't have to interact with the sort of tablet market unless he wants one, decides, oh, I'm not even going to interact with the market. I'm just going to go. And he even said to me, he said, for scientific computing, I'm not worried about my software freedom. I'm worried about everybody else's.
Yeah.
Because for his software freedom, he's pretty sure in scientific computing he'll still have it, but he's sort of seeing the same thing that we are, which is that people are not caring about lockdown. That's what we talked about in our previous
episode.
People
don't care about lockdown, but maybe we could make them care a little bit better. Maybe we should
have
like...
Well, no, wait. You can't make anybody do anything.
Well, but we can explain the situation to them a little bit better.
But there's so many causes.
I've been really
vying for people's attention. And in fact, there's a lot more important causes going on. You know,
I've been excited by the reaction I've gotten to the medical devices talk, but as I said, it only goes part way. So... You know, maybe I just should do a better job. But I was thinking maybe actually having some kind of summit or conversation with gathering people together who care. You won't be invited. Don't worry. You don't care about this issue. But maybe we'd invite Mike.
I think you should invite Mike Winslow because he's very good at thinking about that particular question. And I think his experience at Creative Commons, which we didn't really talk in detail about, but it relates. And I think he's right to invite people from the free software policy world. And basically part of his talk was basically an invitation to get these policymakers involved in what's happening in CC, which I can't say anymore without thinking of a Jesus story of credit card or people. Do you know the story?
Mm-mm.
So on the CC, so it's the pound CC channel on Freenode, they would frequently get people who were looking to illegally share people's stolen credit card numbers.
Oh, really?
Because apparently CC is what it's called on other IRC networks.
Wow.
And Ashish would troll them with pretending like basically answer questions correctly in terms of CC and...
Right.
And the one woman saying, like, I really need CC. And he's like, I do too. It's really important to me. I've been involved with CC for a very long time.
That's great.
So, but I can't say CC. But I think Mike's correct to invite people to be involved in CC with its process and give feedback. I think that if you look back historically at the sort of this huge arguments between Larry Lessig and Stallman over the question of whether or not to have a non-commercial license and all that sort of thing is a non-derivatives license, I think is a very interesting situation. And that discussion never really continued. Larry stopped doing CC, and I guess he has on credit card. Larry stopped being involved with Creative Commons, and then the debate sort of ended because it was Stallman and Larry going at each other.
Well, no, I mean, a lot of those discussions still continued, and I think that the ways that Creative Commons have addressed some of the, taken steps to address the free culture issues, I think are positive steps in this direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thinking of CC is still this smorgasbord of we want to give you every option, including CC proprietary or something, right? I mean, I'm surprised they don't have CC proprietary.
They want to give gateway licenses. But at least now it's much clearer what that means.
Yeah, and the new license picker that they rolled out is better.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Chris Weber did a lot of work on that.
Yeah.
And so it's I think that they have improved, but it's a different there is a culture clash, and I think Mike is speaking to that, and I think subtly Mike is sort of saying that this free software policy world is incredibly insular. And I've sort of watched this whole response to Richard Fontana's Copyleft Next and realized that how insular all this is and how... I think Fontana, I didn't necessarily mean to bring this up, but people are probably going to ask about it anyway. Fontana launched it basically as a toy project, and it got immediate interest, in part because the community is so insular, that three people find out about something and suddenly it's huge news in this little tiny segment of our population.
Yep.
And then actually the indicator there is not, the indicator is our community is too small, because it kind of shouldn't have been news, but it was because it was so small. As a community?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that the GPL generally is a really important license. And I think that's true to a much broader section of the population because of all the industry that uses GPL software across the board. And I think that the initial name of the of the project, which was GPL Next, certainly would have raised a lot of eyebrows anyway because it was coming from one of the authors of the last GPL license.
I guess that's true, but I think that the fact that and this is the same thing and to compare it to something else that I was more directly involved with, the same thing that happened with the whole toy box, which John Corbett correctly called the tempest in a toy box. I mean, the fact that those kinds of little things happen and then suddenly they're this huge news for this very very small group of people.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you.
We're too insular.
I agree with you. And I think that, you know, I think that the problem is this problem is also connected to the first part of Mike's talk, which is that, you know, we're not bringing in a broader range of people like we should be. You know, we stick with our insular little group. And part of that is our failure to explain what we're doing and why it's so important.
Yeah.
I think we can actually, like, I think that's one thing that Creative Commons has been really good at doing is you know, addressing a much wider portion of the population, and we could probably all learn from each other.
I guess, although I still see under a Creative Commons license as the standard use of CC, which is like, it shows that there's just not a lot of knowledge and understanding out there about what's, and people don't want to know things in depth. I mean, this is the classic thing of most people in the world, if they know about any of this stuff, and so you take the population that knows anything about any of this, they think the FSF, the EFF, the SFLC, the Conservancy, CC, and Apache Software Foundation are all the same organization, right? They can't tell the difference between any of those organizations. They have no idea. They're just like, oh yeah, that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the people that know, which is already a tiny segment of the population. Then you take an even smaller subset of that, people can actually make a distinction between all those different organizations.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think that under a Creative Commons license has been going out of favor. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because of the implementations that CC has worked hard on.
Yeah, that's true.
Different web services where you can't just, where you're choosing which license it is that you want to
identify for your works. I agree, but it was, I mean, the fact that that text was out there at any point is sort of like repeating the mistakes of free software, which I think is Mike's point. Mike's point is that we know better about this, and I think his point about license proliferation is interesting because he's like, we scoff at, oh, you're writing hardware license, which I do. I'm like, oh, you know, pick your favorite free hardware license when no one in the free hardware community has made the case why GPL doesn't work. There's nobody who really understands it who can say GPL does not work because no one can make that argument to me, especially GPL v3. And so what do? As a GPL v3 expert, I scoff at them, which is wrong. It's wrong for me to do that. There's no question about that.
Well, it certainly keeps us more insular.
Agree. And that's my whole point here, is that it keeps us more insular, and it means that there is going to be these professional licenses. And Mike's point is, well, is that really that bad? But shouldn't we be trying to help them? My problem is when I go in to try to help them, I just try to educate them about what the GPL says. And then there's like this disconnect because they've got a document they've written and they're you know, I'm about to quote an episode of Star Trek: Next Generation.
Go for it.
So I was gonna in the second part of Reunification Part Two, where Spock says, "Like the early Vulcans, these people are struggling to find a more evolved philosophy." And I feel like that when I talk to these people, they're like, "Well, they really want to do that," and I should be like Spock. I should go live on Romulus and help them reach that point in a patient sort of way. But he's got like 125 years on me, and he's a much better diplomat, so he's able to do that with the Romulans, and I don't know how to do that with the free hardware community, with the free culture community, with these other people, where my expertise would probably be, maybe it's arrogant to say, but probably be a help to their efforts. And instead, I'm over here scoffing at them. And I admit that that's wrong.
Well, you're not actually scoffing now, which is good.
But,
Your mention of Star Trek totally had me in this little distracted little...
Well, you're more like Spock, you know.
I am?
Yeah, you're much more able to be patient and communicate with people.
That's interesting. It must be my half-human side. But anyway, what I was about to say is that...
As Spock said, Sarek would have called this mission a fool's errand.
One of the things
I have learned to see, as he says in that episode, beyond the pure logic could be possible.
I'm really excited about having a baby is to get one of those, to get some of those little Star Trek little outfits that they saw on Think Geek. And so that's what I was totally thinking about.
Well, you have a child, they get to watch Star Trek. They're not going to like it, though. That's the worst part. Because kids never like what their parents like.
But my parents like Star Trek.
But you don't...
We watched it together.
But you were older.
No, not when I was watching the original series with them.
Spock. See, that's the great thing about if you've never watched Star Trek: The Next Generation, and you only watch the old series. And I'm speaking mostly to Richard Fontana here.
This is a very Fontana-centric episode.
Well, I mean, the thing is that when you see Reunification, which is an amazing episode, of course you have to see all of Next Gen first, but when you get to Reunification, you get Spock and no Shatner. I mean, that's sort of the holy grail of the old series, is you have to deal with Shatner being there to get Spock.
In my family, Shatner was always very popular. I'm sorry.
What is wrong with you people?
He was good.
He's not good at acting. His character is not all that interesting either.
Yes, he is. Yes, it is. I'm sorry. This is like, we're talking about like emotional feelings of TV shows from my youth. I have like my response is so.
As Picard says to Spock, this sort of cowboy diplomacy can't be tolerated in the Federation.
We liked the cowboy diplomacy. We liked the reference to him as a, you know, cowboy in space.
Yeah.
We loved that.
Oh, well, you know what Spock says to Picard in that moment. He says,
I can't remember.
I was engaged in cowboy diplomacy hundreds of years before you were born. Not hundreds, but years before you were even born.
Right.
Which I feel was.
Like we should end there.
That was 70 years, actually.
How can we improve upon 70 that? Years.
I don't know. So I'm sorry if I've spoiled Reunification for anyone.
Thanks to Mike Linksfair for his talk.
And a programming note. I'm not going to cut. There may be a delay in our next episode, and we're warning people now. Ascon followed by Gwadek could cause trouble.
Yep.
We're just letting you know.
Reason Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Reason Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Reason Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Reason Freedom website, faith.us. That's faif.us.